Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. Again, you make my week. Here it is, the middle of the week, and I get to talk to people all over the world who actually have a conscience, who actually have an interest in truth, and who are probably interested in a lot of the things I'm interested in. So it's just a pleasure again to be with you and to be talking to you. Life on my end, by the way, is going well. My website continues to grow. Please go and sign up for frequent alerts. It'll help you find out, it's free, what I'm doing every week, anything new that comes up that I think is interesting in the world. Frequent alerts, it's free, easy to sign up for, keeps you directly in touch with me. And it's on my website, so when you go to frequent alerts at bregan.com, you get to see the website as well. But you'll get a mailing. You'll get a mailing once a week, that roughly once a week, that actually has information that indicates what's going on of interest, and then you can go directly to it through my website. So the frequent alerts. And also my YouTube channel. Those of us who are fortunate to actually get a channel and we have enough stuff on it, please go there and sign up for the YouTube channel, whatever one does in this technological age, to put your name onto it, because all of that shows folks that there's a group, that there's a lot of people who are supporting what we're doing. And our Facebook, which Ginger runs, is, I think just about 20,000 now. And she said, and we don't buy fake people for our Facebook. Some other people apparently do. All of these things, this technological world, is somewhat beyond me. On today's alert, I talk about Paddock, the mass murderer about whom we are learning nothing from, Las Vegas, and his autopsy report shows a pattern of metabolites of Valium that indicates a person who has been using the medication on a regular basis, at least within recent times, leading up to his death. And the newspaper that got this information through getting it from a judge, ordering it from the folks who do that work in the coroner's office, they titled their headline that nothing was found in the autopsy of interest. And well, actually it is interesting. And we'll be talking about this today. It's a perfect day for me to have on Andrew Thibault. You may have heard Andrew on the air before with me in 2016, June 29th. But you may have also seen my frequent alert about his amazing movie that has just come out. And I want him to tell you as much as he can about the exciting news surrounding it. Andrew, are you there?
I'm here, Dr. Bregan.
Oh, good. The connection sounds good. The connection sounds good. The movie is really, really good. And I provide a link to it. I think that link still works. and it's about amphetamines. It tells a story vividly and caringly about a human being, a marvelous human being, who becomes a murderer while taking this medication. It's really, really a good movie. Speed Demons is the name of it. By the way, it's filmed really beautifully. Who did the filming, Andrew?
I did, Dr. Brayman.
Yeah. You know, it's really good. What's your background in film?
Well, this I had cut my teeth on some other documentary style and informational videos, but this is my first, feature length effort. So I appreciate that compliment, Dr. Bregan.
Well, you know, I've seen a bunch of these. I'm in a lot of them over the years, and usually, they just don't hit the sweet spot of showing care and concern and of looking at a person's life in a real way and looking at the data in a real way and having really good experts and just filming it in an interesting fashion. So folks, I just think that this is a really good movie, but let me hand you over to Andrew, who's and his last name is spelled T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T. He's got a good website with the name murdermeds.com. That's really a great title, too. That's kind of title my wife, Ginger, when she's looking for titles, salivates over and hoping she can find it. It still exists, you know, in the magical places you go to get these URLs. murdermeds.com, not one you'll easily forget. So now let me unleash Andrew on you, because he's been doing a lot more than just this film, and let him talk about what he wants to talk about for a while. Let me sit back, Andrew.
Hi, Dr. Bregan, thanks so much. I really appreciate your positive feedback on the film. It was a labor of love. It took almost 3 years to make. Granted, two of that was litigation with the Food and Drug Administration to recover some of the adverse event reports relating to homicidal reactions to some of these medications. So that added some additional time to completing the film. But it's also interesting that you mentioned Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter. There are many parallels to the Myron May case. Myron May, of course, was the 31-year-old attorney who turned into a mass shooter, was an honor student and first a public defender, then a prosecutor who, became a spree shooter at the University of Florida at Strozier Library. And it's a troubling pattern of the kind of obfuscation and subterfuge that's being, and disinformation that's being put out by authorities. You mentioned, a little bit about the trials and tribulations that the media had in terms of just getting hold of the autopsy report for Stephen Paddock. It was reported just last week that the coroner's office was, denying the judge's order to release that autopsy report, stating that they were still finishing it, which really begs the question, since the guy was cremated reportedly months ago, what they were trying to put the finishing touches on. But what was interesting in the case of Myron May was the Tallahassee Police Department investigative summary completely omitted the toxicology findings that there were 0.24 milligrams per liter of amphetamine found in this young attorney's blood. And that's a pretty blatant omission because the investigator in the case went so far as to include some text in the report by an individual who is not a medical person, insinuating that Mr. May suffered from schizophrenia, which he was defensive about. I thought that was an interesting inclusion in a report that blatantly omitted the fact that he was on a drug that is known to cause psychosis. So I'm not sure why it is. Dr. Bragan, but it seems that the authorities in this country seem to be trying to spin or omit information about the connectedness or potential link between these acts of violence and the medications.
Well, it happens all the time, and it really began in quite early. And in 1994, when I wrote Talking Back to Prozac with my wife, Ginger, we were able still to go into newspaper reports, and they would say what drugs the person was on, the autopsy material would be released, the toxicology. And it was so obvious that there was a lot of mayhem and murder and horrible automobile, violent automobile accidents going on and surrounding just Prozac mostly at the time. And now that material is just missing. And I can remember the transition when the Washington Post described a woman who had herself killed by the police by threatening them. And she was loaded with antidepressants, and I knew that from other sources, and the Post wouldn't report it. I think that that the drug companies have to have teams that follow up on all of these significant events and curry favor with or threaten or make offers to the people who are in the coroner's office and the newspapers. It has to be something like that. I was involved in a legal case where a judge was very positive toward our viewpoint, and then he got scandalously attacked by in the press organized by Eli Lilly, and then Lilly was in the courtroom and the judge changed his approach. But we rarely get to actually see something like that. But it's amazing.
It's logical that the press would gloss over this because they're getting $5.2 billion per year in direct-to-consumer advertising from the pharmaceutical industry, you know, something, as you know, is illegal in every other country on the planet except for New Zealand, the United States. So that makes sense. But the idea that the authorities, whether it be prosecutors or law enforcement, be actively engaged in a cover-up is kind of mind-boggling. But now that you mention it with regards to teams, I've personally reviewed the Pfizer prosecutor's manual. There's another case in the FDA files that I was able to obtain through the lawsuit in which a district attorney calls the FDA, I believe it's the FDA, might have been the drug company, and inquires once they have a positive toxicology on Lexapro and Xanax, whether this medication could have caused them to kill. Even goes so far as to say that the medication made him become agitated. Now, I'm sure, Dr. Bragan, all this information was kept confidential and was not disclosed to the defense in that case. Because if it had, it would have been a bombshell revelation that even the prosecution had contemplated the possibility this medication could have caused this individual to kill. Yeah. So it's a very disturbing trend, especially, considering that we like to think of ourselves as a democracy, that we would have the self-censorship that's occurring at the level of the press. Then we have this foot dragging, at the very least, disinformation at the worst, taking place on the part of law enforcement. So, a case in point would be Devin Patrick Kelly, who went into the church in Sutherland, Texas, and shot 26 people. You know, why haven't we seen a toxicology report on this gentleman yet? So it's a disturbing trend, but that was part of the challenge of making Speed Demons, and we didn't shy away from that challenge. We made multiple public records requests. You know, we included body cam, dash cam, surveillance footage, forensic records, all of that. And sometimes we had to get attorneys involved to get the information that we were requesting. And as you know, in the case of the FDA, I had to sue them myself. So we got this information and painstakingly stitched it together to try to tell the story of amphetamines, you know, commonly referred to as speed. And, you know, speed or amphetamines had a pretty long and sordid history in the United States, particularly in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, to the point where they were actually banned as a prescription drug in 1973 by the FDA. But amazingly, these drugs have been, their image has been rehabilitated, and they've been refashioned and remarketed for attention deficit disorder in children. And now they've come roaring back into our lives as Americans, and we have 6 million people right now on stimulant drugs in the United States. So Speed Demon's Dying for Attention is meant to be a kind of a comprehensive anthology, if you will, of this history that, unless recorded, could potentially become forgotten. We had our first go around with Speed in this country, and it didn't go well. It culminated with the drugs being banned. So, you know, we need to be aware of our history so we don't repeat it again. One of the more interesting aspects of the film that I found to be interesting was how we retrace the roots of Adderall, which, as you know, is a very commonly prescribed medication for attention deficit. Well, that drug was originally a weight loss drug marketed under the trade name Obitrol. And one of the drug's most famous users was Andy Warhol. In fact, it was reported that he and his entourage took Obitrol to stay fashionably thin and stay up all night. But one day, one of the members of his entourage, a woman by the name of Valerie Solanas, shot and critically wounded him. You may recall Hollywood even made a movie about the incident called I Shot Andy Warhol. What they left out of the film was that Andy had actually picked up his prescription of Obitrol that morning. Solanas was confined to Elmhurst Hospital, and she was later diagnosed with having paranoid schizophrenia. And as you pointed out in Speed Demons, the symptoms of amphetamine psychosis closely mimic those of schizophrenia. Now, these incidents were happening with such frequency that a doctor by the name of Everett Ellenwood conducted a study, and it was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry in 1971, and he associated assault and homicide with amphetamine abuse. Now, the case studies were, you know, just normal people, a long-haul trucker who was taking amphetamines to stay awake, a housewife who was taking amphetamines to stay thin, and they turned into killers on the drug. What was interesting is the majority of those who then withdrew from the amphetamines had their symptoms of schizophrenia subsided. So it got so bad that, as I indicated, in 1973, the FDA withdrew its approval for the drug Obitrol. They cited a lack of substantial evidence of effectiveness and a lack of proof of safety. But brazenly, Rexar Pharmaceuticals, which was later acquired by Richwood Pharmaceuticals, which in turn was acquired by Shire, continued marketing Obitrol even after it was banned in 1973. And we know this because the FDA inspected Rexar in 1982, collecting samples of the drug and informing the company that it was marketing the drug without an approved new drug application. So incredibly, even though the drug was no longer listed in the FDA's Orange Book of approved drug products, Obitrol continued to be listed in the PDR, the physician's death reference, because doctors and pharmacies could still get their hands on this banned drug. So this is a case of the FDA being effectively asleep at the wheel and not offering any kind of regulatory oversight whatsoever. And we're talking over two decades of a company marketing a drug that had been banned. So, you know, kind of emboldened by the sense of impunity, Richwood, which was later acquired by Shire, took out a full-page ad in 1994 in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology, rebranding Obitrol as Adderall and marketing the drug for attention deficit in children instead of obesity in adults. So now you have a diet drug that's refashioned and rehabilitated as an ADHD drug. And then in 2015, things then came full circle and the FDA approved the ADHD drug Vyvanse as a diet pill. And then last year in 2017, Adderall, which has its dodgy past, was rebranded and rehabilitated by Shire as Mydeus, a new 16-hour speed pill. It's like you need a scorecard to keep the names and indications of these amphetamine drugs straight.
Now, they must have, when they put that ad in for ADHD, for Adderall, which, folks, is a, it's just a mixture of amphetamines. It's straight amphetamine and different salts of amphetamine. They must have, at that point, gone through and gotten their a new drug application approved for
well,
ADHD.
That's the thing. They didn't, and it was so brazen that it prompted deeper regulatory scrutiny, and then finally the FDA got off its rear end. They had a very rare closed-door meeting with executives from Richwood Pharmaceuticals and regulators and lawyers from the FDA in, I believe it was 1995. And essentially, the they demanded that they reapply or apply for, you know, submit a new drug application. So that application was only approved in 1996. So when they took out that full-page ad in 1994, the drug had been banned for 21 years, and they had not submitted a new drug application. And during that meeting, Richwood's attorney admitted that they had been marketing the reformulated product since 1973. And on the top of that memo, it says Obitrol/Adderall. So it's the same drug.
People should go to jail for things like that, not be given new opportunities to market.
Right. I mean, this is illegal behavior that was essentially rewarded. And it's interesting to note that while this drug was originally a weight loss drug, it was approved in 1996 for ADHD and narcolepsy, but not obesity. So they really succeeded in really resurrecting, not rehabilitating, but resurrecting a drug that was that was supposed to be dead.
Yeah.
And now, amazingly, if you're a parent who questions whether it's a good idea to put your kid on speed for a diagnosis that has become increasingly controversial, well, you're painted out as being unreasonable or trying to second guess the experts, when in reality, it was originally a diet drug. And somebody had the bright idea to give it to kids for ADHD.
Well, the use of these drugs to suppress children goes back to the 50s when they had Benzedrine, which was eventually taken off the market because it was so addictive. And they gave it to children in a facility that was just a, you know, just a lockup for distressed, abandoned kids. And they reported that the children got a lot quieter on speed, and which they do, and they get subdued on it. They also get psychotic, and they also can get euphoric, and they can also get lots of other things, insomnia. But it does, in general, tend to make people apathetic, and that's why it's a drug that the teachers like, and why it makes it easier to have kids around the house. And that it was never though used in a wide scale as a drug, you know, for quieting people the way the antipsychotic drugs are. And then it also was used for depression, and they marketed it for depression. It's what a checkered past with presenting of this drug. And then the Academy of Medicine, when the FDA started to look at grandfathering drugs, would not grandfather the amphetamines for depression. So there's such a checkered history around this drug of abuse. And it was abused in epidemic proportions around the world in the 60s and 70s. There was severe abuse epidemics of the illegal use of the drug. God, you're giving me new information, and it must be like when people listen to me, stalking, you know, like, wow, that really happened.
It's really unbelievable, and it was just, you know, it was like pulling this string of yarn, and it just kept more and more revelations. And you know, there were some things that we came across, such as what you just mentioned there, that the stimulants were also marketed as antidepressants that we just didn't have time to include in Speed Demons. But I will tell you, one of our co-executive producers, Sue Carey, who was mentioned in the not mentioned, she was profiled, her family's profiled in Alan Schwartz's article about selling ADHD in the New York Times, had provided me with a transcript of congressional hearings from 1971 conducted by a congressman out of New Jersey. He was a Democrat by the name of Neil Gallagher. And he had some very controversial hearings that involved kind of coercive medication of children. And what really shocked me was that there were parents that were complaining about this back as early as 1964. So, you know, it started becoming very prevalent and predominant in the schools, or the pushing this medication and making referrals for children. At that time, it wasn't even called attention deficit disorder. It's called minimal brain dysfunction. So they've changed the names of the drugs, they've changed the names of these alleged conditions. But it was shocking for me to find that we'd actually had national hearings on this epidemic that culminated 2 years later in 1973 with the drugs being banned. And that now here we are, you know, 4 years later, over four decades later, and you know, these drugs are in fashion again.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about those hearings is they actually had educators and other people of note coming on to the hearings and testifying that it was ridiculous to drug children to make them better students or better children. Much more protest then. And as I recall, the estimated number of people, children who were on the drug at that point was like 150,000. And, you know, that was being called just ridiculously large number of children to be drugged. Now it's a tiny fraction, tiny, tiny fraction. And there's much less concern now about this issue than there was then.
And
history
yet we have 4.6
is an in and out and up and down affair.
Yeah, and now we have 4.6 million children on these medications in the U.S. Now, to your point about the, you know, making children apathetic, it's, you know, commonly referred to as a paradoxical effect. But one of the very astute members of Congress that was questioning the panel in these hearings asked one of the employees of it was the agency that preceded Department of Health and Human Services, at what age does this paradoxical effect cease? And the doctor replied that he would not put a child on the medication who was 12 years or older. And yet we, you know, in this country, children over the age of 12 are commonly prescribed these medications.
Well, now it's an adult medication.
Right. But the issue is it's not a paradoxical effect anymore. And then it starts having more of the adult effect that we're familiar with, which often ends in psychosis and mania and hallucinations and the like.
Actually, so, I mean, this is such a weird world we're talking about. The worst apathy was produced in children who were 3, 4, 5, and 6 years old. I talk about that in a number of my books, including Talking Back to Ritalin, because the early studies showed that up to half of kids were getting depressed and apathetic and let down visibly, clinically, the younger children on these drugs. And in general, you know, children are the canary in the minefield. They're the ones, you know, the canary is supposed to topple over and die before the miner does from the carbon monoxide. And in this case, children are the canaries in the minefield. They get even more disturbed on these drugs than adults do.
Mm. So true. And so some other things that I wanted to kind of touch on, we maybe breezed over a little bit in Speed Demons in the interest of time, that we can maybe delve a little bit deeper into here in our discussion. One of them was the incident when the FSU shooter, Myron May, called his former girlfriend, Dr. Danielle Nixon, who herself is a pediatrician who sometimes prescribes medication to kids with ADHD. And he indicated that he found a camera that police had put in his vehicle. See, Myron believed that he was under surveillance because he's hearing voices that would say something that was contextual to what he was doing. So he was absolutely convinced that he was under surveillance. So you may recall in the voice message that he left for Danielle, Myron was adamant about giving an object that he had found to Danielle so that she could know he wasn't crazy, thinking it was a camera. The thing is, as you might have guessed, when we talked to Danielle, she said it was just a piece of plastic. And then you may also recall in the voicemail to Danielle, Myron stated that he was surrounded by police. Well, based on our research, that incident simply never happened. The only time Myron May was ever surrounded by police was the night he was gunned down outside of Strozier Library at FSU, November 20, 2014. So this goes back to the point that you made in Speed Demons, Dr. Bregan, about amphetamine psychosis causing visual hallucinations. Because he was actually not just hearing things that weren't there, but he was seeing things that weren't there.
Yeah, that, when people start abruptly visually hallucinating, it's usually a drug reaction. Not always, but it's usually a drug reaction. Something neurologic is being thrown out of whack. More typically, people hear voices or feel things in their body. Your movie's so good, folks. It has a lot of good commentary going on. And it's way beyond, we're talking about speed, but the movie is about psychoactive substances. So you don't leave thinking this is all about speed. You get a sense that this is the tip of the iceberg of drugs that affect the brain and mind, of psychiatric drugs. You're not left with, this is just about amphetamines. And I thought that was good and an important thing you did.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out. And, you know, I can promise you, Dr. Bregan, I can't discuss it on the air right now, but we do have a project in the works that is going to be addressing some of these other types of psychoactive drugs. But you're absolutely correct. And you know, especially as pertains to the lawsuit against the Food and Drug Administration, the files that we obtained related to not just amphetamines or stimulant drugs, but to all classes of psychotropic medications. So we definitely want to continue to kind of beat that drum and get this message out there. But we thought amphetamines was a good place to start, particularly because it really was at the root of this tragedy that occurred in Florida in 2014. And we wanted to bring attention to that because Myron May, who was, you know, by all accounts, a brilliant young man, had received a scholarship at FSU, was an honors graduate from FSU. His friend and colleague, who's now a congressman, Congressman Matt Gaetz, I remember him quite fondly. Judge David Taunton recalled him quite favorably. His high school teammates, his former attorney, partner, an employer in Houston, Texas. So he was universally seen as just a great guy, the kind of guy who would give you the shirt off his back and go the extra mile to help people. And yet the media really did a number on him. And it just went along really well with the narrative. At the time, if you recall, back in 2014, was it Tim Murray, the congressman now defrocked, who had this precipitous fall, that was pushing the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, and the narrative of that, coming out of the Newtown investigation, the Sandy Hook investigation, was that these people need access to mental health care, and that these acts of violence are occurring because people are not getting necessary mental health treatment. Well, that turned out to be completely bogus, that these people were actually under the care of a doctor at the time and taking medications and had, in fact, therapeutic doses of the medication in their system when they committed these crimes. So, this is this is really the motivation that we had in first drawing attention to amphetamine psychosis and mania. But, you know, as you point out, there are a lot of other drug classes are implicated in these acts of violence.
Yeah, folks out there, I mean, consider what we're learning about today in regard to can you trust the authorities, and in particular, in this case, the FDA. I mean, the FDA, just to give you a little background, has a system called MedWatch. Spend a lot of money on it. And people are empowered. You could be a consumer, a victim. But in the past, it was mostly doctors and pharmacists, hospital pharmacists and doctors were the main source. Now we're getting more general sources. And the drug companies who are required to send in materials to MedWatch. And the FDA organizes all this material. It gives out free, within a week or two, you can get 5 years summary of all the reports on any given drug sent into them, well organized for you to look at. The whole purpose of this is to help monitor so we can see patterns that would give us some indication of harm from a drug. That's the most important function, is to see the patterns. And quite often, if there's a pattern of something like, you know, six patients die of a liver disease reported to them in association with the drug, eventually that drug might even come off the market just from a few reports, because the pattern is so strong. It fits with the known effects of the drug. And it makes physiological sense, and so on. Now, they're getting all these reports on violence and murder. And we know from Tom Moore's research article on this in 2010, which you can find, by the way, on my website at www.123antidepressants.com. www.123antidepressants.com. You can find Tom's article. It's about all the drugs that in the FDA, who has the big patterns of violence, and you'll see it's right there. You know, it's antidepressants, it's stimulants, it's benzos, it's drugs that stimulate and disinhibit. So there are the patterns evolving in different directions. So apparently the first person to ever really look at this thoroughly is on the air with us now, Andrew Thibault. And he looks at all of this and he says, FDA, send me the cases, the case reports. I got the summaries. That's great. That look like the patients have committed murder on drugs. Send me the reports. Is that basically what happened, Andrew?
You're absolutely right. And it's interesting, and
let me just finish the wrap for one few more words. So then the FDA says, No, why, the FDA should have said, thank you so much. Come give us a talk and we'll get organized behind this and we'll use our data for the most important thing we've ever used it for in our whole history, looking at the patterns of violence and murder. And they had Tom Moore's article to help inspire them to look further, and they tried to shut you down, right?
That's the net effect. And, you know, I can validate that they had Tom Moore's article, because once I finally got the reports, you know, it was reoccurring. It was Tom Moore, I think Kurt Ferber, again, Joseph Glenlawn's article that had been published in PLOS One. So they were well aware of that. But as you pointed out, Dr. Bregan, you're supposed to get these, I think you just said, within a week or two. The law actually says within 20 business days. And so I bent over backward, giving them an opportunity to comply with the law. And they drug their feet. And eventually, after 10 months, I'd had enough and just filed the Freedom of Information lawsuit. And that's, you know, when we got these reports. Now, incredibly, in the pleadings, the FDA made two revelations. And I think the first was their attempt to minimize any possible correlation between the drug from a causality perspective to the violent acts that were committed. And these were all homicides, over 700 cases. And that was, they indicated that the reports had not been evaluated so that they couldn't corroborate the information. Now, this is incredible because the reports were dating from 2004 through 2014. So what the FDA admitted, essentially volunteered in an attempt to minimize any potential causality, was that they hadn't even reviewed the reports. So some of these were over a decade old and they hadn't even looked at them.
It's amazing. Thank you for this work, Andrew. Thank you for this work you're doing and the great film.
I just didn't have it in my constitution to turn away. Once I understood what was happening and what I had found, and then, it's always the cover up that's more, interesting than what's actually being covered up. Like, why would the FDA go to great lengths? I'm with you. They should have said, well, thank you, Mr. Thibault, for bringing this to our attention. And, we'll get back to you. We'll review these. No, they did everything they could to minimize it. What's also interesting, and of course this won't get covered in the wider media, is right in the pleadings, again, volunteered. I didn't have to depose anybody. I didn't have to subpoena anybody. The FDA volunteered that these cases involved, quote, school shootings, end quote, and other murders that had received extensive press coverage. So this is something that you would think the press, exercising normal journalistic curiosity, integrity, would want to chase down. But that's not the case. So it's right in the pleadings that these are school shootings and other murders that had extensive press coverage, and that the FDA hasn't even bothered to evaluate these reports. So, and to your other point about, you may have been referring to the drug nifrazidone, also known as Cirzone, which was an antidepressant, which, yeah, I think they found a half a dozen, maybe a dozen tops cases where there were liver reactions, patients just dying of liver failure. And it's interesting because the FDA at that point did not withdraw its approval for nifrazidone like it had done for Obitrol. Now, as they did in the case of Vioxx, they simply pressure the company to voluntarily withdraw it on their own so they don't have to go through the bureaucratic hassle. They don't want to be seen as being in the business of denying drugs anyway, because now the pharmaceutical industry essentially is the funding source that's propping up the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. But to put that in context, you're talking about a half a dozen cases, maybe a dozen cases, and a drug is withdrawn from the market. Here we have over 700 cases linking homicides to psychotropic drugs, whereby the FDA admits that these involve school shootings and homicides that received widespread press coverage. And yet there's scarcely a ripple. You wouldn't know by the press that this has even happened. So I do appreciate you having me on the show to talk about this. Speed Demons is a documentary meant to educate people about the negative side effects of amphetamines. But we are working on additional projects to bring some more of these stories into the light. And with Speed Demons, the idea was to just bypass the media and go straight to people's living rooms, to their television set. And so I'm happy to report that Speed Demons is available on Amazon today, but we've just made an agreement for worldwide distribution for the documentary, which is going to take it global. So hopefully we can inoculate some people around the world to this message, to prevent them from this virus that started here in America from spreading. ADHD is an American invention that we are exporting. These pharmaceutical companies are publicly traded. They need to grow or they die. And so they need to expand into emerging markets. They need to expand into Europe. They need to expand into Africa and the Middle East. And so they push the disease, these conditions, globally. So this is really, a tremendous development in terms of getting the message out to people. But it's my commitment to you here today on the air that we're going to be doing more of the same type of thing to bring this information to a wider audience.
By now, people out there have to be asking, who is this man? Andrew Thibault, who is he? Well, who is he? How did you get here? How did you get to this place?
Yeah, you know, I wish there was a more interesting story behind this, Dr. Bregan, but it's pretty simple. My child was caught up in this ADHD diagnosis dragnet, and I just happened to be somebody who was involved in IT, and I delved into the FDA data, and it yielded some answers that I never fathomed that I would find. I had no way of predicting that I would find this information. And in fact, if you had asked me 4 years ago about this, or I was even listening to your show 4 years ago, I probably would have thought you were out of your mind. I had no idea this information existed. And I had no idea that the media was suppressing it. I had no idea that the authorities seemed to be, you know, doing their best to suppress this information. So I'm just a parent, just like anybody else, but I tripped over some information, stumbled over some information that I thought was very important, and that, you know, my constitution wouldn't allow me to walk away from, that I just had to, you know, continue to delve into it, to go the extra step, to sue the FDA, to get these files and to make this documentary. And, you know, I'm not going to stop there and continue to bring these stories to light, because the public needs to know. You know, the pharmaceutical companies, as you alluded to earlier, are really operating with impunity. I saw a story just last week, in fact, where there was a town in West Virginia of population 3,000 that had been flooded with, I believe it was 20 million doses of opioids. I mean, that's criminal. There should be people in jail. You know, we've gotten to the point where prescription drugs have overtaken automobile accidents as the third largest cause of death in America. So it's unrestrained corporate greed and unregulated pharmaceutical companies that is just killing Americans in the tens of thousands. So I feel a burden to, you know, to bring this information to light.
Yeah, and looking at what you've gone through with the FDA, it's so clear that instead of actually being a watchdog agency, it's a protector. You know, I've called them the junkyard dog of the pharmaceutical industry.
That's a good description.
Not the watchdog. I mean, they're very nice people there. I deal with some people there occasionally. They're very, very nice people. And I think a lot of them don't even like this, probably. But it is such a political organization. It's so politicized that it is not a watchdog agency. And from what I understand, and I don't have vast knowledge in this arena, it's pretty much what happens with watchdog agencies. They get bought by the very people that they're supposed to be watching. They get petted by them and fed by them and entertained by them. And they become their dog. You know, I think I shouldn't really impugn dogs in this manner, because I love dogs.
It's an insult to dogs.
It's, you know, an insult to dogs, yeah.
You know, some of this information we alluded to, but much of it we couldn't. One of the individuals that we had interviewed is attorney Jonathan Emmerd, who had actually worked with Able Child trying to recover files from the Sandy Hook tragedy. So he told us a story that unfortunately we didn't have the time to include it, of a congressman by the name of Billy Tozen, I believe, who back in, I'm not sure the time frame of this, but this was when the Medicare Part D was passed. He essentially shepherded this legislation, which was authored by, you know, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association, PhRMA for short, the pharmaceutical industry's main lobbying arm, had authored this legislation that he shepherded through Congress that essentially made it illegal, impossible for the federal government to negotiate down the price of prescription drugs. And then he promptly left and became executive director of the organization if my memory serves me correctly, as to what Mr. Emmert had stated in an interview. So this is really distressing. And when you think that, you know, the FDA publicizes very loudly when they put an Amish man in jail for selling flaxseed oil, and yet you have these criminals who are literally killing tens of thousands of people with opioids who are getting off scot-free. It's just, it's unfathomable. And I think it can be traced back to some very, you know, you've heard the expression, don't let any crisis go to waste. Well, you can trace it back to 1992, essentially, where the Prescription Drug User Fee Act was passed. And if you recall, this was the period when the AIDS epidemic was really at its pinnacle. There were protests in the street. People were dying. And they even made the film Dallas Buyers Club about the length that people would go to get these drugs. And so they authored this legislation that essentially did two things. One, first was it allowed fast tracking of drugs. So now these drugs require very little regulatory oversight. But the theory behind that was, well, the FDA is already overworked, and so who's going to pay for this fast tracking of these drugs? And so they came up with a bright idea that the pharmaceutical company would underwrite the Center for Drug Evaluation Research. And they do that through new drug application fees, which today are $2 million plus for any new drug that you apply for, as well as licensing fees for the drug once it's approved, which really amounts to be a royalty that the FDA gets from the drug, as well as manufacturer site licensing fees. So that's really when the shift occurred. And now you have, you know, our president bragging in a State of Union address that the FDA approved more drugs this year than any other year. That's not exactly something that you want to brag about, especially when you consider that Dr. Alan Francis, in his interview, had mentioned that previously about a third of these drugs were approved. So I think what we're missing here is the safety and efficacy piece. Just getting a drug fast-tracked and approved shouldn't necessarily be the end result that we're seeking. The whole point of the FDA is to be a watchdog. You have to make sure that the drugs that are being marketed are safe and effective.
Now, I so many thoughts going through my head. There's a couple of things I wanted to pick up on. You know, you mentioned the attorney who was trying to get the state of Connecticut to release the medical records to show what medications the shooter was on, who went into this elementary school and just murdered a large number of little children, shooting them in the back of the head multiple times. I mean, it's just a horrible, horrible thing. And Abel Child, you know, videoed the meeting that they had with the assistant attorney general, and I've seen that tape, and you've probably seen it. I can't remember if you played it on the in your show, film. And he comes out and he says, "Well, we can't release this information, or people would on what the shooter was taking, or people would stop using their drugs." And by the way, yeah, that sounds so much like a drug company talking point. So, I mean, these people are gotten to in some way or another. These agencies are gotten to.
Well, you know, you follow the money. You know, you could look at our last presidential race and the amount of money that our presidential candidates received from the pharmaceutical companies is astronomical. You know, they spread $240 million around Congress. That goes a long way. With 535 members, you're looking at over, you know, almost $500,000 per congressman, or congressperson, I should say. So it's a lot of money and it's a lot of influence. And I did watch that video. Patrick Quinashe, I believe, was the attorney's name. And, you know, I don't think adherence to doctor's orders should be our primary concern. I think outcomes should be our primary concern. And I think we can all agree that Sandy Hook was not a good outcome. And it was reported that he had been prescribed Lexapro and Celexa. But interestingly, his psychiatrist reportedly, I believe his name was Fox, destroyed the records and reportedly had relocated to New Zealand, which coincidentally, as I mentioned earlier on in the show, is the only other country in the world that allows pharmaceutical advertising. So
Andrew,
I'd have to
you
agree
are
with
such
you
a fount of information, and you have a memory for detail that is embarrassing to listen to compared to my own. It's just amazing to have you go over details as well as the larger scope on all this. You're really a gift, and I'm just so glad you're doing all the stuff you're doing. And your website, again, is very, very valuable. And I just want to keep helping you in any way I can. And we'll talk more about that. Have you done a blog anywhere about the show? I didn't see anything on Mad in America about your movie.
No, I haven't. But if you want to write one, feel free to do so. I just haven't had the time. It's been, you know, pretty hectic getting the film out and then trying to get it to a wider audience. But I reckon I probably should at some point.
Well, I'd like to see you doing more writing. And if I can help with that in any way, we can talk about that later on. Because some of this material about the overview of what you found with the FDA is, it just tells the public in the most direct way I can imagine that the FDA is not protecting you or even the victims of mass murder. It's protecting itself and the drug companies. It doesn't want to admit that its mistakes have made horrific mayhems occur, and it doesn't want to sell out its benefactors, who not only support the FDA, but then hire the FDA officials as double dippers after they retire. It doesn't, you know, it's not going to stand up to the people it's monitoring. And the story you tell, I think, gets to that on the show today as clearly as anything else that can be documented, that you had to go to court at your own expense to force the FDA to give out materials, which they routinely do give out and should give out, which are the actual case reports that they summarize in the summaries they give out. And they give out the numbers, and they're supposed to be available, and that they would selectively not give out the most important possible reports, murder, homicide, is just an absolutely horrific situation. I'd love to see you to write something about that. It wouldn't have to be very long, and I think it might help get your movie some attention, but it sounds like you're doing a great job in that manner already. Again, spelling his last name, THIBAULT, and great work, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bregan.